From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Thorn on the Threshold by Manly Wade Wellman. Mr. Gallander, a superintendent of an asylum for the insane, was by training hard to daunt or embarrass. But he was not enjoying this final interview with a newly discharged patient. His round, kind face showed it. "You are the second name on my list, doctor," Rowley Thorne told him across the desk in the office. "It is not a large list, but everyone implicated in my unjust confinement here shall suffer. You are second, I say, and I shall not delay long before giving you my attention." Thorne's lead-colored tongue moistened his lead-colored lips. "John Thunstone comes first." "You're bitter," said Gallander, but neither his tone nor his smile were convincing. "It'll wear off after a day or so of freedom. Then you'll realize that I never bore you any ill will or showed special discrimination. You were committed to this institution through the regular channels. Now that you've been re-examined and certified cured, I feel only happiness for you."
"Cured?"
snorted Thorne, his great hairless dome of a head lifted like the turret of a rising submarine. His eyes gleamed above his hooked nose like the muzzles of the submarine's guns.
"I was never insane. False testimony and stupid arbitrary diagnosis landed me here. It's true that I had time in your institution to perfect various knowledges by meditation. Those knowledges will help me to deal with you all as you deserve." His eyes gleamed palely. Dr. Gallander drew himself up.
"You're aware," said the doctor, "that this kind of talk may well land you back in the ward from which you're being released, if I call for yet another board of examination." Thorne sprang up from his chair. He was big and burly in his shabby clothes. He straightened to his full height, 6 feet and a little more. "No," decided the doctor. 6 feet and considerably more. 6 feet and a half, perhaps 6'7".
"You're growing," Gallander cried,
his voice shrill with sudden baffled alarm.
"Call in your examiners," it was Thorne's voice, though his tight-lipped gash of a mouth did not seem even to twitch. "Call them in to see, to judge if I am crazy when I claim powers beyond anything you ever."
He towered up and up, as if his wide slab shoulders would hunch against the ceiling. Dr. Gallander, cowering in his chair despite himself, thought a mist was thickening before his eyes in that quiet, brilliantly lighted room. Rowley Thorne's fierce features churned, or seemed to churn and blur and writhe. Next moment, abruptly, the illusion of height and distortion, if it was an illusion, flicked away. Rowley Thorne was leaning across the desk.
"Give me my release." He picked up the paper from in front of Dr. Gallander, who made no sound or motion to detain him. "If you're wise, you'll pray never to see me again. Except that prayer won't help you."
He tramped heavily out. Left alone, Dr. Gallander picked up his telephone. Shakily he called Western Union, and shakily he dictated a wire. Then he rose and went to a wall cabinet from which he took a glass and a bottle. Flouting one of his most rigid customs, he poured and drank whiskey in solitude, and it was a double drink at that. Then he poured another double drink, but he collapsed before he could lift it to his mouth. When John Thunstone returned to New York from the South, his air would have puzzled even his few close friends. The drawn, wondering expression around deep dark eyes and heavy jaws was contradicted by the set of the giant shoulders and the vigorous stride that took him about the business he must now transact. Dr. Gallander still in a coma, said the intern at the hospital. Half a coma, anyway. He rouses to take nourishment when it's put to his mouth. He turns over from time to time, like a healthy sleeper, but his pulse and his involuntary reactions are feeble, and he doesn't voluntarily respond to voices or other stimuli more than once or twice a day. Diagnosis not yet complete. Which means that the doctors don't know what's the matter with him, summed up Thumbstone. Here's my authorization from his attending physician to see Dr. Gallander. The intern reflected that he had heard somehow how John Thumbstone could secure authorization to do almost anything. He led the way along a hospital corridor and to the private rooms where the patient lay, quiet but not utterly limp. Gallander's face was pale, his eyes closed tightly, but he opened his mouth to allow a nurse to introduce a spoonful of broth. Thumbstone looked, a long, strong forefinger stroking his cropped black mustache. Then he bent his giant body, his dark, well-combed head close to Gallander's. Dr. Gallander, said Thumbstone quietly but clearly, do you hear? It seemed that Gallander did hear. He closed his mouth again and lifted his head, a dreamy, languid hair's width, from the pillow. Then he relaxed again. You can understand me, said Thumbstone. You sent me a warning wire. It was forwarded to me from New York. I hurried here at once to learn about Rowley Thorne. Thorne, muttered Gallander, barely louder than a faint echo, said I would be second. You sent me a wire, repeated Thumbstone, bending still closer. I am John Thumbstone. Thumbstone, said Gallander in echo, even softer than before. He will be first. And Gallander subsided with the gentlest of sighs. He did not open his mouth for more broth. He does not rouse more than that, volunteered the nurse. It's like anesthesia of some sort. He will be first, I will be second, said Thumbstone under his mustache, as if to record the words on his memory. To the intern he said, what's the full report on him? They stepped into the corridor again. He was found unconscious in his office at the asylum, said the intern. He had just released the man you mentioned, Rowley Thorne. Later a clerk came in and found him. There was some spilled liquor, and at first they thought intoxication. Then poisoning. Now nobody knows. Thorne was checked by New York police, but there's no evidence to hold him. Did Thorne leave New York? He gave a Greenwich Village address. The police have it. Apparently he's still there. Did you ever see a case like this, Mr. Thumbstone? It's not quite human, somehow. Thumbstone glanced back through the doorway, eyeing the quiet form on the cot. No, not quite human, he agreed slowly. More like something similar among insects. Insects, Mr. Thumbstone? Tear open a wasp nest. Not while I'm in my right mind, muttered the intern, smiling slightly. In such nest, went on Thumbstone, mildly lecturing, you find other insects than wasps. Sometimes caterpillars, sometimes grubs, in some cases spiders. These strangers are always motionless. They've been stung into control by the wasp. Because the wasps lay their eggs in them, replied the intern. He shrugged his shoulders to show they disliked the idea. When the eggs hatch, the young start eating. But in the meantime, Thumbstone said, the prey remains alive but helpless, waiting the pleasure and plans of its conqueror. He looked at Gallander once again. I won't talk about hypnosis in its very derived forms, or about charms, spells, and curses. You're studying medicine, and you'd better remain an empiricist. But don't worry about the patient unless you hear that I've been destroyed. And don't wait with your breath held to hear that either. Goodbye and many thanks. He left. Outside it was evening, and he sought his hotel. Knowing in a general sort of way what might be at the door of his room, Thumbstone found it. A tiny fresh white bone from a toad or a lizard, bound with a bow of red silk floss and emitting a strange sickening smell, had been pushed into the keyhole. His key thoughtlessly inserted would have crushed the bone. Carefully, Thunstone pried the grisly little object out, catching it in an envelope. Standard Obeya device, he decided under his breath. Someday I'll have time to do a real research and decide whether this is a primitive African method, as Seabrook and Hurston say, or a modification of European diabolism. Rowley Thorne will try anything. Now he studied the jamb and threshold for possible smears of black liquid or scatterings of gray-white powder. He found neither, sighed with relief, and finally unlocked the door and let himself in. He made two phone calls, one to police executive of his acquaintance, who gave him Rowley Thorne's Greenwich Village address, the other to room service for dinner and a drink to be sent up. The waiter who brought the tray up, also a folded newspaper. "Left for you downstairs, sir," he told Thunstone. "Room clerk asked me to bring it to you." "Thanks," said Thunstone. "Put it on the table." When the man was gone, Thunstone took the salt shaker from the dinner tray and lightly sprinkled a few grains on the paper, watching closely, then took it up and unfolded it. On the upper margin was written a name he knew, and which reassured him. He turned to the classified advertisements. Under personals, an item was circled. New threshold of spirit. You may glimpse truths beyond imagination. Demonstrations nightly, 8:45. Admission, $1. This was followed by an address, the same Thunstone had just learned from his friend of the police. Said Thunstone softly and slowly. He put the paper aside and turned to his dinner. He ate heartily, as always, but first he salted every mouthful. He even sprinkled a few grains in the brandy with which he finished. When the waiter had taken away the dishes, Thunstone relaxed in his easiest chair. From a bureau drawer he produced a primitive-looking pipe with a bowl of dark blue stone, carved carefully with figures that looked like ideographs. It had been given him with reassurance as to its beneficent power by Longspear, a Tisca Indian, a Phi Beta Kappa from a southern university, and a practicing medicine man of his tribe. Thunstone carefully filled the ancient bowl with tobacco mixed with nick-nick, and grimacing a bit, for he did not like the blend, smoked and smoked, blowing regular clouds in different directions. When the pipe was finished, Thunstone wrote a letter. It began with a sentence. "If anything fatal or disabling overtakes me within the next few days, please act on the following information," and went on for several pages. When he had done and signed his name, he placed it in an envelope addressed to one Jules de Grandin at Huntington, New Jersey. Now, from his lower drawer, he produced a rectangular box the size of a dressing case, which showed neither keyhole nor draw catch. By pressing at the middle of the lid, Thunstone made it fly open. Inside were several objects, closely packed, and from among them he selected a reliquary no more than 2 inches by 3. It was of ancient brick red clay bound in silver, and its lid, too, must be pressed in a certain way to open. From it Thunstone took a tiny silver bell that clanged once as he lifted it, with a voice that might have deafened had it not been so sweetly clear. The bell was burnished white, but anyone could judge its age by the primitive workmanship. It had been carved probably from a block of metal rather than cast or hammered. Upon it were carved two names, St. Cecilia and St. Dunstan, the patrons of music and silversmithing, and a line of Latin, in letters almost too fine to read, "Es mea conticorum terror vandimicorum." "My voice is the terror of all demons," said Thunstone aloud. Muffling the little thimble-sized object in his handkerchief, he stowed it in an inside pocket. By now it was nearly 8 o'clock. He went out, mailed a letter, and signaled a taxi. Once there had been two rooms in the apartment, one behind the other, perhaps for parlor and dining room. By the removal of the partition, this had become one room, a spacious oblong. Its dull walls were hung with gloomy colored pictures and two hangings with crude but effective figures of men and animals embroidered upon them. At the rear had been built a platform a few inches above the floor level, its boards painted a flat brown. Upon this stood a square table covered with a black velvet cloth that fell to the platform itself. The front part of the room was filled with rows of folding chairs, as for a lecture audience, and fully 50 people sat there. Two candles on the velvet-covered table gave light enough to show the faces of the audience, some stupid, some rapt, some greedy, some apprehensive. There were more women than men, and more shabby coats than new ones. A rear door opened, and a woman appeared and mounted the platform. She was youngish and wore many bangles and scarves. In the candlelight, her hair appeared to be rather blatantly hennaed. From the open door behind her stole slow, soft music, from a little organ or perhaps from a record on a phonograph. The woman faced the audience, her dark eyes big and questioning. "Do you know why you are here?" she asked suddenly. "Is it for curiosity? Then you may wish you had not come. For worship? But you may not be ready, because a call came to you that was more direct than what you have read or heard. That will be true for some of you." Her wet eyes fluttered shut. "I'm a medium, sensitive to spirits both alive and dead. I feel influences, and not all of them honest. In this room is a spy. He calls himself a journalist. Will he speak?" There was some fidgeting and muttering, but nobody spoke. The woman's eyes opened and fixed coldly on a young man in the rear of the room. "You," said the woman, "you came here to find something sensational or ridiculous to write about. Get out." "I paid my dollar," began the reporter. "It is returned to you," she interrupted, and he flinched, then stared at a crumpled bit of paper that had sprung into view in his empty hand. "Go, I tell you." "I have a right to stay," insisted the newspaper man, but even as he spoke, he rose. It was an involuntary motion, as though he had been drawn erect by a noose of rope. Stumbling a little, he went to the door, opened it, and departed. "Does anyone else come with enmity or a sneer?" challenged a woman on the platform. "I see a girl in the front row. She thought she would see or hear something tonight that would amuse her bridge club. She has her dollar back. Let her leave." There was no protest this time. The girl rose and hurried out, clutching in her hand a bill that had come from nowhere. "To the rest of you, I think, came a clear call," resumed the speaker. "Why else do you think you read a vague advertisement and on the strength of it made a journey and paid money? I know your hearts, or enough of them to feel that you will listen. All I have said is mere preparation, as though I had swept humbly with a broom before the man who will now show himself." She turned toward the door and nodded, or perhaps bowed a little in reverence. Rowley Thorne appeared and took her place on the platform. The music stopped. There was absolute silence. Rowley Thorne stood behind the table, leaning a little forward with his hands on the velvet cover, so they had a candle on each side of him. He held himself rigid, as if to photograph himself on the attentions of those who watched. A man in dark clothes, of great width, with a chest like a keg, and a squat-set hairless head. The candle glow from beneath his face undershot him with light and made strange shadows with a jut of his chin and brows, the beaky curve of his big nose above his hard-slashed mouth. His eyelids did not flutter, but his gunmetal eyes roved restlessly, as though searching every face in the audience. "Watch me," he bade after some seconds. To those who watched, he seemed to be floating closer, but that was only an illusion. He had spread his shoulders and chest so that they filled more closely the space between the candles. His features too broadened and turned heavy, like the memorial sculptures, sometimes carved gigantically on granite bluffs. Like a face of granite, his face maintained a tense immobility, as though Rowley Thorne must strive to keep it still. He grew. He was size and a half now and swelling. Abruptly, his face lost control, writhing and blurring, and he lifted his hands from the table to straighten himself. There were those in the audience who wanted to move toward Thorne, or away from him, or to fall on the floor, but none moved, and none felt that they could move. Thorne rose like a magnifying image on a cinema screen, higher and more misty. seeming to quiver and gesture madly as though in a spasm of agony. One person or perhaps two thought he was being lifted on an elevator apparatus concealed behind the velvet-draped table, but then he had stepped sidewise into full view. No doubts were possible now. He stood upon great columns of legs, a gigantic and grotesque figure out of proportion beyond any freak in a sideshow. His eyes glared as big as peeled eggs, his mouth open like the gaping of a valise, and his hand like a great spading fork moved toward the candle flames. At its slap they went out, and there was intense darkness in the room. Quiet in that darkness, save for a woman in the audience who was trying to stifle sobs. Then the candles blazed up again. The henna-haired opener of the program had come back through the rear door and was holding a twisted spill of paper to light the two tags of radiance. Rowley Thorne leaned against the wall at the rear of the platform, gasping and sagging as though after a staggering effort. He was back to his own proportions again. "I did that not to startle you, but to convince you," he said between great gulps of air. "Does anyone here doubt that I have power? I have stood on the threshold of the unthinkable, but from that unthinkable I bring knowledge for anyone who cares to ask. Questions? Anyone question?" The woman who had sobbed stood up. "I came to learn what happened to my sister. She quarreled with her parents and left, and we couldn't trace..." "Write to Cleveland," bade Rowley Thorne, his breathing even now. "Write to Dr. J.J. Avery on East 23rd Street. He will tell you how your sister died."
"Died?"
echoed the woman faintly, and sat down abruptly. "Next question," said Rowley Thorne. "It came from another woman, who had lost an emerald set bracelet that she called a family heirloom. Thorne directed her to search in a locked trunk in her attic, looking for a discarded red purse which held the jewel. After that came a question from a grizzled oldster about Bronx politics, which Thorne settled readily but with patent disdain. A young man's query as to whether he should marry the girl he had in mind drew from Thorne a simple never, staccato but leering. There were other questions, each answered readily, convincingly, and more than often the reply was discouraging. But Rowley Thorne was plain telling each questioner the truth that he had dredged up from somewhere unknown. When no more voices ventured, Rowley Thorne permitted himself to show one of his smiles, all hard mouth and no eyes. This had been a first meeting of what may be a communion of help and knowledge, he said, vague and encouraging. All who stayed had belief and sympathy. "You will be welcomed another time, and perhaps more things will be revealed." He paused on exactly the proper note of half-promise. He bowed in dismissal. The people rose from their seats and filed out, murmuring to each other. When the door closed, Thorne turned to his henna-haired companion. "You got the names?" Each, as they stood up to speak, she nodded above a penciled list. "I took each name as a person came in and checked them in their seats. Nobody saw me writing. Their attention was all for you." "Good." He took the paper from her. "I count 11 who brought up private matters they might better have kept to themselves. And even the smallest inquiry was admission of..." He broke off, glaring into the remote rear corner, where lounged a human bulk as great as his own. "Continue," said the voice of John Thunstone. "I'm listening with the deepest interest." Thorne and his companion faced savagely towards the big man. The red-haired woman drew herself up. "How did you come here?" she demanded tremulously. "And how did you remain without my knowledge?"
"Your mind-reading powers are not as perfect as you think," replied Thunstone, rising from where he sat. "When I was a boy, I learned to think behind the wall. The untrained minds of the others were open to you. You could detect mockery and enmity and banish those who felt it. Meanwhile, I had slipped in with a crowd and sat in this dimmest corner." He addressed Thorne.
"Why did you break off? You were going to say you had a hold on all who listened to you here?" Thorne's lips twitched thinly and moistly. "I venture to remind you
that you are a trespasser in a lodgings leased by myself. If something tragic happened to you, the law would reckon it no more than justified by your intrusion. Law? Echoed Thunstone, walking toward him. He and Thorn were very much of a size. Each grinned with his lips and gazed with hard, watchful eyes. The red-haired woman glanced from one to the other in plain terror. Law, Thorn, said Thunstone again. You have a sound respect for such as help you. I know of nobody more bound by rules than yourself. A hold, I was saying, on those who heard and saw your performance tonight. That checks almost exactly with what I foresaw. You know so little that we pity you, taunted the red-haired woman. Store up your pity for your own needs, Rowley Thorn told her. Thunstone does not consider himself a pitiable figure. I permit him to go on talking for a little while. The classic demonologist, Thunstone continued, agree that those who attend evil ceremonies and do not protest or rebel are therefore sealed communicants of black worship. You've collected the beginnings of a following, haven't you, Thorn? You're already planning how to rivet your hold on every person. On this one by fear, on that one by favor, on the other by blackmail? I am able to stand alone, growled Thorn deeply. But those you serve demand worshippers, and you must see to the supply. You have failed before. I know, because I caused the failure. I have disrupted your ceremonies, burned your books, discredited and disgraced you. Thunstone's hard smile grew wider. I am your bad luck, Thorn. The red-haired woman had stopped. Twitching up her skirt from a sheath strapped to her leg, she drew a slim dagger, but paused, staring at it. It's broken, she muttered. Even your tools fail you, pronounced Thunstone. Thorn, still standing on the dais, drew a deep breath. It swelled him like a hollow figure of rubber. The woman stared at him, gasped, and drew away. She could not accustom herself to the phenomena. Thunstone smiled no longer as he stepped up on the dais, close to Thorn. I'm not afraid of you in any size or shape, he said. Around Thunstone the air was close and hot, as though he had entered a cave in the side of a volcano. The dimness of the room seemed to take on a murky red glow, but in that glow Thorn's face and outline grew no clearer. He only swelled. He was already a head taller than Thunstone. Moloch, Lucifer, Pimoth, Thorn was saying as though to someone behind him. Anector, Somiator, sleep ye not. It is the unknown that terrifies, rejoined Thunstone, as though speaking a rehearsed line in response to a cue. I know those names, and for what beings they stand. I am not afraid. Awake strong, holahaha, chanted Thorn, powerful Eben, mighty Tetragrammaton, Athe, Stock, Seda, Iruye. Thunstone felt around him the thickening, stifling heat, sensed the deepening of the red glow. There was a crackle in the air as of flames on the driest day of summer. How true, mused Thunstone, while he fixed his eye on the burgeoning form of his enemy, was the instinct of the primitive priest who first described hell as a place of gloomy fires. Hands were reaching for Thunstone, hands as large as platters. Thunstone smiled again. Do you think I am afraid? He inquired gently, and stepped forward within reach of his hands. A chorus of voices howled and jabbered, like men trying to sound like animals, or like animals trying to sound like men. Thorn's great gaudy fingers had seized Thunstone's shoulders and swiftly released their grip, while Thorn cursed as if in sudden pain, for Thunstone had seized the crumpled sleeves upon the mighty ridged arms, twisting them so that they were bound and constricted like tourniquets. Thunstone's clutch could not be broken. Thorn's hugeness above him heaved and struggled, but did not seem to have gained weight in proportion to its size. Thunstone's own solidity anchored it down. To me, Thorn was blaring. To me, you named, and you nameless. They rallied to his call. Thunstone felt blinded and at the same time dazzled by that hot redness, but beings were there, many and near around him. He clung to the sleeves he had grasped, and Thorn could not break away. Stifled, numbed, Thunstone yet summoned his strength, and with a mighty wrench toppled Thorn's overgrown form to its knees. That was enough for the moment. He let go and drove a hand under his coat to the inside pocket. With a full-arm sweep, he swung the little silver bell, its voice unthinkably huge as the master chime of a great carry-on rang joyously in that dark, lost corner. It drowned the voices that held at it. It clanged them into dismayed silence, and they shrank from it. Thunstone knew that they shrank, though mercifully he could not see them plainly. They retreated, and with them ebbed the redness and the dumbness and the breathless heat. Thorn was trying to say something, either defiant or pleading, from farthest away and farther still. The bell drowned his speech, too. Things became plainer to the eye now. The room was just an ordinary dim room. Thunstone looked for Thorn and saw him and saw through him, just as a giant outline faded like an image from a screen when the projector's light winks out. Thunstone stood quiet a moment, breathing deep. He cuddled the little bell in his palm to muffle its voice and gazed at it with gratitude. "I remember part of the old hymn of the bell," he said aloud. "I call the people, I summon the clergy, I weep the departed. I put the pestilence to flight, I shatter the thunderbolts, I proclaim the Sabbaths." He looked around for the red-haired woman. "A holy man, whom once I helped, gave this bell as a gift. It was made long ago, he told me, to exorcise evil spirits. This is the third time I have used it successfully." Carefully, he returned the bit of silver to his pocket. Stepping from the dais, he walked across the room and switched on a light that threw white brilliance everywhere. Turning his head, he looked hard for some sign that Rowley Thorn had been there. There was none. Tramping a few steps more, John Thunstone opened two windows. "This place smells most unoriginally of burning," he commented. The red-haired woman crouched motionless in the furthest corner from the dais where Thunstone and Thorn had stood together. Stooping above her, Thunstone touched her shoulder. She looked up at him and rose slowly. Her face was as pale as tallow. "What will you do with me?" she managed to ask. "Leave you to think how narrowly you escaped," he replied. "You are not a lieutenant of Thorn, only his servitor. Plainly you know little or nothing of what he was really trying to do. I recommend that you review the story of the sorcerer's apprentice and keep clear in the future of all supernatural matters, for you have used up a good deal of your normal luck in escaping tonight." "But what, she stammered. "The explanation is simple, if you care to accept it. Thorn was on the threshold of something. Science calls it another dimension. Mysticism calls it another plane. Religion calls it another existence. He could communicate with entities beyond and claim them for allies. He was able to draw some powers and knowledges, such as his ability to prophesize to those dupes who came. Such powers might have been useful to him and rankly terrible to the normal world." Thunstone produced his pipe. "By the way, I am heartily in favor of the normal world." Nearby stood a telephone on a bracket. Without asking permission, Thunstone picked it up and dialed a number. The nurse who answered told him jubilantly that Dr. Gallander had suddenly awakened from his trance, very lively, cheerful, and hungry. "Congratulate him for me," said Thunstone, "and say that I'll join him in a late supper." He hung up and continued his explanation. "Thorn gambled everything when he called his allies into this normal region of life to help him. I wanted him to do that, because when defeated they would go back, and with them they would take Thorn. I don't dare hope that he's gone for good, but he'll have considerable difficulty in returning to us." "But where?" pleaded the woman. "Where did he go?" "The lesson to be learned from all I have said and done," Thunstone assured her gently, "is not to inquire into such things."